Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The United States Capitol building is sometimes referred to as the People's House, which can feel cruelly ironic when you consider the challenges of the people who live within a stone's throw of it. The Sanford Durant family lived just 17 blocks behind the Capitol building. Matriarch Cheryl, a single mom, raised three kids, Emmanuel, Denise, and Akil, who everybody calls Smurf. In a new documentary, we meet this family intimately, as their life was recorded for nearly two decades by a family friend and by the family members themselves. We watch as Smurf gets deep into street life, selling drugs, which leads to tragedy. Emmanuel's a straight arrow who's doing everything he can to graduate from high school and be a fireman, while their sister Denise works hard to look after everyone because their mother, a kind, sweet woman when she's sober, is gripped by addiction. Here's a clip from the documentary titled 17 Blocks, where we hear Smurf describe life in their neighborhood as uncomfortable.
I was locked up for like a year and some change. But I went right back to selling drugs. As soon as I came home, I ain't wait a month. Boom, selling drugs.
You want to be comfortable, and our conditions is uncomfortable. And when you're uncomfortable, you make bad decisions. So that's what it is. These streets, man, they vicious. You know what they do? They soak your ass up.
The film is a distillation of more than 1,000 hours of footage. Variety calls the film uncompromising and devastating. The Washington Post described it as remarkable. Joining me now is the director of 17 Blocks, Davey Rothbart. You might have found his book called Found, The Best Lost, Tossed, and Forgotten Items from Around the World. His documentary, 17 Blocks, released by MTV Documentary Films, debuted at Tribeca in 2019 and won a total of 25 awards there and other festivals. It's streaming now from virtual cinemas around the country. Davey, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So one of the first scenes of the film is this pickup basketball game in 1999. Which is how you met Smurf and Emmanuel. Smurf's 15, Emmanuel's just 9.
Yeah.
So you were mid-20s-ish, yes?
Yeah, I was really early 20s. I was living far from home for the first time myself, from Michigan originally. But, you know, we just played basketball every day, and Smurf is such a friendly guy. One day after hoops, he said, "Hey, why don't you come back and have something to eat at our place?" So I got to meet their mom, Cheryl, their sister, Denise. And we just had such a fun time. They asked me to come back the next night, and it just, you know, it was the beginning of something. Cheryl likes to say that the family adopted me, and you know, honestly, that's really how it felt to me, because like I said, I was so far from home, and I was maybe in need of some family myself, and the family really took me in.
Were you seeking to make a movie when you first met them?
Well, I was interested in filmmaking, but I really, you know, there was no real plan here. I had my first video camera. I had just got it. It was nothing special, just a little handheld thing that used old video cassettes, you know, and I started learning how to, you know, learning how to use it, teaching myself, and I would bring it over to the house, and Smurf and Emmanuel and Denise, they took a real interest in the camera. So we really learned how to use it together. We would just walk around the neighborhood, you know, interviewing people on the street. Sometimes we'd hang out at their apartment and interview each other. You know, I would interview them, they would interview me, but there was no real plan. It was essentially home videos for the first long, you know, many years.
When did you realize this was something else besides y'all just kind of goofing and having fun and, you know, documenting for the family?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, really after about 10 years of this, because even after I moved out of D.C., I stayed close with the family and I would come back for holidays and we would, you know, sometimes film together. It was just, filming was just one activity among many that we liked doing together. But when someone in their family became the victim of gun violence, which was so prevalent in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. so common, but that was when everything changed. And Cheryl, their mother said to me, you know, she said, well, I was there the next day just to help in any way I could. And she said, "Where's the camera?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" She said, "No, look, like, this is so common here. I've seen so many friends lose children to gun violence, but this is different." Like, she had the wisdom and foresight right in that moment. She said, mm-hmm. like, we have our family member, we have footage of them since they were a little kid, like throughout their life. And this is something that she recognized, like, people outside the neighborhood could never really connect with this story is because it was just felt like a it was a statistic. Mm-hmm. She said, "This can really," she said, "what I want is people to be able to walk in my shoes. You know, I want people to know what's really going on." That's how Cheryl described it. And so she said, "We have to film all of this. We have to keep filming just like we've always been doing." So me and other members of the family, we just continued to film in those weeks and months that followed as Cheryl and her family walked through this, you know, the heartbreak and misery of losing a loved one to gun violence. So, you know, it's extremely raw and intimate. And all of us passed the camera around and captured these moments. What I didn't realize that then was that we would keep filming for 10 more years.
So let's talk about the actual film. Once you've started to craft this into a film, the first scene shows us now Cheryl, about 60, visiting the house. She grew up in this area in D.C. between Capitol Hill and the Anacostia River. And she's greeted by this nice, smiling 20-something white guy. And the scene really serves two purposes. One, it's a signal to gentrification. And two, we learn right away that Cheryl is fragile. Why did you start there with her revisiting her old home?
You know, I think we wanted to, there's a couple of reasons, just to be totally honest and transparent. One thing is that, you know, a lot of the early footage in the film was shot all the way back in like 1999, you know, shot with a pretty low grade video camera, home video camera. And so we wanted to show that, like, the footage will improve, that you won't just be watching like ancient home videos for the whole hour and a half. So, but I think from a more storytelling perspective, I mean, you know, we wanted people to see the scope of time. You know, it's incredible to even just see people age over 20 years on camera, mm-hmm. to turn from children into grown people with their own kids. And then even Cheryl, you know, you get a glimpse of her at the beginning, you know, how she is now 20 years later. And then you kind of flash back in time to 99 and see what these kids are like in their youth and what Cheryl was like when she was, I guess, my age now. Mm-hmm.
You know, when we meet Cheryl and her family 20 years earlier, she's really gorgeous. And she's like Taraji P. Henson would play her in the movie.
Yes, yes. Well, Taraji P. Henson is from Southeast D.C.
Yeah.
And grew up actually just several blocks from Cheryl. And yes.
She's that vibe. The kids are cute. They're a loving family, but they have financial struggles. One of the main reasons is Cheryl's drug use. How aware were you at the time of how serious her drug use was?
You know, that's a really great question. When I met the family, you know, Cheryl, like a lot of folks who have struggled with addiction that I know, is good at hiding their issues. And so it was a couple months really before I realized that things were amiss. And, you know, she's smart and resourceful. And even though she had serious issues with drugs, she knew how to keep appearances up. That being said, you know, the more and more time I was spending at the house, the more I started realizing something was off. And then Cheryl really just became quite candid with me and told me about her struggles. And you know, it had really been a lifelong thing since she was a teenager herself and had suffered some pretty severe traumas. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I've seen those struggles. And of course, the tough thing about addiction is that it sort of ends up repeating itself even in someone's children. So, you know, I saw not only Cheryl struggle with it, but some of her kids as well.
And this is where the movie is unique and really special, I think, is the way that you reveal how serious her drug use was and its impact on the family. And I'm going to give a little bit of something away because the way it's sure. revealed is quite intimate. It's filming her basically passed out on the bed, fairly uncovered, while her daughter's at the foot of the bed on the phone talking to somebody and kind of telling us, "Don't film mom like that." And she's just groggy and she sort of grunts, and the daughter puts the covers over her sort of bare mother. In that editing process, what were your boundaries for family privacy?
Sure. Well, I will say, you know, I think that moment kind of mirrors my own sort of understanding, you know, and then Cheryl had frank discussions with me about it. And one thing I just have to give Cheryl and really everyone in the family, Smurf, Denise, Emmanuel, Justin, you know, I need to give them credit. Just the courage that they have shown in this film to make themselves so vulnerable, you mm-hmm. know, to talk so honestly about the challenges they faced and just the journey they've walked, it's really incredible. That's why the film is so raw and so intimate and so powerful, I think, is because they made those decisions and they said, we have to put everything in the film. And so, you know, this has been Cheryl's vision, and we've all collaborated so closely over the last 20 years. But Cheryl, for example, you know, one time she said to me, look, I've talked with you a lot about my drug use, and we've discussed it on camera even. But she said, you've never filmed me actually using drugs. And she said, people need to see this. Like, it's ugly. Like, I'm not proud of it. It's shameful, but people need to see what that actually looks like. And I said, well, yeah, that's a good idea. We should film it sometime. And she said, well, right now, like, let's go. I'm about to use, like, let's bring the camera in here. Let's do this. So I think their willingness to really, you know, put themselves out there and be vulnerable and share every bit of this story is, you know, not just the heartbreaks, but the triumphs too, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of warmth in the film as well.
The hope and the uplift, you know, but to be able to share all that is so meaningful.
Oh, we got guests in the back. My guest is Davey Rothbart. The name of the documentary is 17 Blocks. Let me just throw the skunk on the table with this one. You're like a white guy from the Midwest, and you are deeply embedded and with this family. Were there conversations about race during the course of this filming and the course of putting this together? Oh, somebody's having a bad day.
This is my son, Desi. Okay, buddy.
Hi, Desi. Okay,
you're okay.
You need that pouch.
Okay, I'll get you a pouch, buddy. Give me 30 seconds.
Sure. My guest is Davey Rothbart. Do you want to go get him? Go get him one. I can vamp for a few minutes. So one of the things that's really interesting about the film, you guys, is that, as Dave was saying, there's just these very intimate moments. They're with the family when the mom's using. They are with Smurf when he is in court. Davey has footage of blood spatters on the family's vestibule when a robbery leaves one family member dead. Some of the stuff is very difficult to look at, but a lot of it is really important to see. Davey, I was describing to people some of the things that you capture on film: blood spatters in the family home after a robbery leaves a family member dead, Smurf drinking 40s and selling drugs. What was the hardest thing to capture?
I mean, look, the family member that died is, I consider, my brother, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to be there to... I think if anything, you know, those moments were, I mean, they were hardest on the family, the siblings and parents who'd raised them. But for me, it was also, you know, those were the hardest, saddest days of my life. You know, mm-hmm. I think having a camera, and I know this is true for other family members who I've talked to, because we, all of us were kind of passing the camera around and filming. The camera, if anything, was helpful to like insulate our feelings and emotions against this like utter devastation. So if you could be focused on like filming what was happening around you, maybe you weren't feeling it as deeply in the moment yourself and could kind of almost like keep your composure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I'm getting choked up just like thinking about it and talking about it right now. But I mean, I think there was just a strong feeling among all of us that we had to keep filming. We had, you know, we needed this person's story to be told, and by extension, you know, because this is one story, but there's, you know, we also wanted to somehow convey the vast scope of this issue. You know, I mean, and gun violence is really just a symptom. You know, we're working with every town for gun safety on the release of the film, as well as Black Lives Matter DC. And one thing we all often talk about is how gun violence is a symptom of many, many other root causes, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's the opportunity gap, unjust sentencing laws, you know, that pull people out of their communities, you know, generational trauma. So, but, you know, there's thousands of gun deaths like this a year around the country. And, you know, but we just felt like we needed to keep telling this, you know, our beloved family member stories. Mm. So,
well, spoiler alert, we've alluded to this, that one of the young man who was sort of on the straight and narrow ends up being shot And we meet the next generation, this little boy, Justin, who looks just like Emmanuel. He talks like him. He moves like him. He's got his same spirit, his same light. And there is this really intense moment where Cheryl is telling this little boy, Justin, and she's watching him play with the camera, that he reminds her of Emmanuel. Let's listen.
Hey, Justin, you're the same exact age Emmanuel was when he got his first video camera and started recording everything.
Really?
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like I'm witnessing it all over again, like it's being a rerun, you know? Sammy, I got 11 more years until I die.
No, don't say that.
You sound like Uncle Emmanuel.
What did you want to explore about generational trauma?
You know, look, the movie's called 17 Blocks because the family lives 17 blocks from the Capitol building. And for this boy, Justin, who's 9 years old now himself, for him to know, to even imagine that his trajectory is going to include an early death, mm-hmm. you know, it's sad and it's crazy, you know? And you know, we're influenced by what happens to the people in our lives, the generation before us, whether it's violence, addiction, or any other struggles. And so, you know, that's a heavy, heavy load for a 9 year old to be carrying, knowing that his uncle, you know, who there's, you know, pictures of all around the house, you know, to know mm-hmm. to know what his fate was, and to think, oh, that might happen to me myself. And so, you know, 17 Blocks it's also calling the movie 17 Blocks is kind of a challenge and a provocation, I think, to the people that are in those halls of power and, you know, just 17 blocks away, you know, deciding how resources are allocated, you know, and really to anyone watching the film to say, you know, what can we do to change outcomes for folks in neighborhoods like Southeast DC, you know, mm-hmm. and to give more opportunities to kids like Justin.
So I don't want to give away the end, but I will say there's a lot of hope and there are some good things that happen to this family. I'm assume you're still in touch. How is everybody doing?
We talk almost every day. So yes. And they're really sort of against all odds are flourishing at the moment. So some members of the family have just over Smurf, you know, who you started out by playing some clips of his audio, you know, he actually runs a supermarket, and he's been promoted several times since you see him working, starting to work there in the film. And he's one of the managers of the store, you know, really working a ton of hours during the mm-hmm. pandemic, but just doing so well. His kids are flourishing. They're on the honor roll, Justin as well. And you know, Cheryl, while she continues to, you know, like, you know, addiction is a daily struggle. Mm-hmm. You don't just get cured, but she's doing really, really well. And she just found a new house in Southeast DC that's in a nice spot. And so, nice. You know, look, life's been extremely hard and the pandemic has only made it harder, but, sure. But they're really hanging in and they're really proud of this film. They're just so thrilled that people are you know,
they're
interested
gonna hear
in their story.
People are going to hear their story. The name of it is called 17 Blocks. You can watch it now in virtual cinemas around the country. To find out where, go to 17blocksfilm.com. Davey Rothbart, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.